All right, so this is Bio 241, and it is September 23rd. And we're in the middle of, actually toward the end of chapter 6, we were talking about membrane potentials last time. And so let's just review a couple of those key concepts a little bit. Like, what do we mean by potential? What is that really?
Voltage.
Voltage. It's really the voltage. And where are we going to measure this voltage? How many places do you have to have to measure a voltage? You got to have two places. You can't measure a voltage at one spot. Okay? So a voltmeter always has two electrodes, and those two electrodes got to go to two different locations. If you put them in the same location, then there is no voltage at that one spot, right? There's got to be a difference in charge according to some location. And batteries have two terminals on them, like you have in your car. And as a matter of fact, the cell has two terminals. And you could consider one terminal on the outside of the cell and the other terminal on the inside. So across this membrane right here, we have a voltage, and we call that the potential. Membrane potential, because it's across the membrane.
So that it goes like from 12 mm to 145. That's
okay.
The voltage?
Okay. Now on this slide right here, what we have is, I'm going to tell you what determines that voltage. Okay. And it's due in part to a difference in concentration of ions. So we have four different lines on this slide, representing four different ions, and the first one is sodium, and you know it's an ion because of that positive charge, right? So it's an electrical charge, so it has some electrical effect on the cell, and you see, is the concentration of sodium equal on the outside compared to the inside?
No.
No. There's a difference in charge, and when there's a difference in charge, that produces a voltage. And if we use the Nernst equation right here, we can just calculate what the voltage will be due to this difference in concentration due to that charged particle right there. That's what the Nernst equation tells us. You don't have to be able to use this equation, but you should just be able to say, well, we can calculate what the voltage of this battery is if we know there's a difference in concentration. So the key is that you have to know there's a difference in concentration, and for these four different ions, you should know where they are high and where they are low. So for sodium, where is sodium high? Inside the cell or outside? Outside the cell. And for potassium, is it high inside or outside? It's inside. That's the opposite of sodium. Okay, it's the opposite. So those are a couple of the most important to know. So for all living cells, except for just a very, very few, sodium is always high on the outside, low on the inside. Potassium is high on the inside, low on the outside. A couple other compounds that are important, chlorine, again, there's a difference. Because there's a difference in concentration of that charge on chlorine on the outside and inside, what can you tell me, what does chlorine do? It produces what across the membrane? It's not just a concentration, it's also a difference in charge. There's a difference in charge, and if there's a difference in charge, we call that a voltage or a potential. Oh, it's not on the slide, a potential. All right, so chlorine is high on the outside. And calcium, where is it high? Outside or inside?
Outside.
It's almost zero on the inside. Okay. Normally it's almost zero. All right. So now the cell is not doing anything at this point in time. So the cell is at rest. So this is what we call the resting membrane potential. If we were to consider all of the effects of ion concentrations and the sodium ATP pump, and there's another factor that influences that as well, and that is membranes typically have channels for potassium. So potassium can leak out of a cell pretty easily. That affects the resting membrane potential. And does anybody have kind of a feel for what the magnitude of that resting membrane potential is on a typical cell? A typical cell has? Yeah? Okay. 70 millivolts is a good ballpark figure. And which is the negative? Is it negative outside or negative inside? It's going to be negative inside the cell. Okay? Negative inside the cell. So let's all of a sudden put a channel, let's open up a channel for sodium. Okay? So we know it's negative inside the cell, positive outside the cell. Let's open up a channel for sodium. Will sodium want to go into the cell? Yes. Why would it want to go inside the cell? Okay. Okay, but let's see, I want to show you why I think it's very clear to me why it would want to go inside the cell. Where is sodium higher, inside or outside? It's outside, and it's low inside. So the concentration gradient is going to what? Allow sodium to go in. Just by the concentration gradient, that's one force. But what's another force? If it's negative inside, sodium is positive. What can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract each other. So there's another reason why sodium wants to go inside the cell. But when the cell is at rest, it can't because that channel is not open. So sodium would love to go in there, but at rest, it cannot move. Those, there are big protein molecules and DNA, nucleic acids, the protein molecules and the nucleic acid, all those big molecules can never get out. So the big biomolecules typically have negative charges. And what kind of molecule has a negative charge? What do we call that? Anion. Okay, so you have some slides that have a big box right here that says anions. Those can't leave. So those anions are pulling the positive charges in.
And is that -70?
-70 millivolts.
Is it because of all those negative?
It's partly because of that.
Yes.
Partly due to the difference in concentration. Partly due to the sodium-potassium pump. Okay, so there are a number of things that contribute to the resting membrane potential, as well as the permeability of these ions. And we'll have to give you some examples later on in the class of changes in permeability and how that affects the membrane potential. Okay, come on, cursor. Bless you, bless you, bless you. Okay, maybe it will work here. All right, so when I say RMP, that's resting membrane potential, that means it's just a steady, stable voltage across the cell membrane, with the inside being more negative than the outside. Okay, so we talked about all this. So I think we're going to start here, cell signaling. So cell signaling is just a topic on how cells communicate with each other. Some use gap junctions, and I don't have a gap junction on this slide. Here we see, this looks to me like an epithelium. Here are two neighboring cells. They are glued together by various kinds of junctional complexes between the cells. Sometimes we have tight junctions, sometimes we have adherens junctions, sometimes we have desmosomes. So these things attach cells together, but there's a third kind of junction between cells, and that's what we call a gap junction. And a gap junction, so if here, if I just draw that picture, so if we have these two cells with a junction between them like this, a gap junction is some kind of protein complex that actually is a tunnel between the cells. And what can happen is that sodium can move directly from one cell to the next. And don't forget that sodium has an electrical charge, and an electrical charge in motion is a current, so an electrical current can go directly from one cell to another. And that electrical current can act as a signal for this neighboring cell. And of course, you can imagine that happens very fast because electrical signals travel very fast. That's what a gap junction looks like. And in one of the follow-up slides, I have a picture of a gap junction. Okay. So sometimes one kind of tissue is going to release a signaling molecule, and we're just going to generally call that a paracrine agent. That signaling molecule is going to be secreted from the cell, and it's going to move by diffusion according to its concentration gradient, so from high concentration to low, and it's going to move around in the body by various different kinds of ways, but this one we see just moves by diffusion to a neighboring tissue right here, where it's going to signal these cells to change their metabolism somehow. They're going to change something about how they are operating on the inside. So they're going to change their physiology. All right, but in order for these cells to be sensitive to the signaling molecule, they have to have something special. Otherwise, they will just miss this signaling molecule altogether. And what these cells have to have is something we call a receptor protein. So this right here is what we call a target tissue because it has a receptor protein. So, is this blue? Is this a blue cell right here? The blue cells are the signaling cells, and the red cells down over here are the receiving cells. The blue cells send this chemical message, and the red cells can receive the chemical message or be sensitive to it, because why? Because they have a receptor protein. If they don't have a receptor, then this signaling molecule is not going to have any effect on them whatsoever. Okay? And we explain a receptor protein, why it is sensitive to a particular kind of signaling molecule, by the shape. So the receptor has to be complementary to the shape of the signaling molecule. Just like when we were looking at transporters, the shape of the molecules have to match up. So the shape of this receptor has to be similar to the shape of the signaling molecule. Okay. So, here is a synapse. A synapse is a junction between two different cells that are communicating with each other. And there are a couple different kinds of synapses in the body. There are, all right, so a synapse. And a lot of times in this class, I'm going to tell you what the structural and functional unit of something is. And it's just a nice way to think about something that's really big and complicated in very simple terms. And if you can think about, if you can use that terminology, it will invoke all of the complicated nature of this particular topic. So a synapse is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. Okay, so from this you should get what? That there is a structural functional relationship, right, between these two cells that have to match up. All right, so the kinds of synapses. There is an electrical synapse, and the second kind is a chemical synapse. And so a synapse could be thought of also as a space between the cells, a functional space between the cells. And information has to flow from one cell into the next one. So how does information flow from one cell into the next cell? It's got to cross something. What does it cross? It has to cross that synapse. It has to cross a synapse. And there's two different kinds. There's electrical and chemical. Most are chemical. All right, so I'm going to put most right here. There are just a few that are electrical, and we talked about electrical synapses already. For instance, this gap junction right here is an electrical synapse. Because one cell is communicating with another, how is it communicating? Via some electrical current. There is an ion that goes from one cell to the other, and that changes the electrical properties of the cell right here. So this is an example of an electrical synapse. You don't have many in your body. There are, your heart has a lot of electrical synapses. Maybe you can remember that from anatomy. Where do we have gap junctions in heart tissue? Where do we have gap junctions? Anybody remember a picture of what a myocardial tissue looks like? The cells are really short, and where the cells butt up against each other, there's a special junction right there that we call what? Intercalated disc. And part of that intercalated disc are gap junctions, so that if one heart cell gets stimulated electrically, what happens to the whole heart? It gets stimulated electronically. Okay, one muscle cell in the heart under normal conditions can't operate independently of the other muscle cells in the heart. But that's not true of skeletal muscle. Okay? If all your skeletal muscles were connected by gap junctions and I reach forward to pick up this marker, what would happen to all my muscles? They would all contract. That would not be very useful, right? Because even if you could hop around, you couldn't hop in any particular direction, right? So gap junctions aren't really good in most cases. So in most cases, we need a chemical synapse right here. Okay, a chemical synapse. So chemical synapse, information, for instance, in the first cell, which is an axon in this case, information is an electrical signal. We're going to look at the nature of that electrical signal quite a bit. And that electrical signal is a nerve impulse coming down this axon. It stops right here at the axon terminus. And that signal gets converted into a chemical, which then diffuses across the space between, say, this neuron and this muscle fiber right here. And that chemical then binds to a receptor on the muscle, which then sets up another electrical signal that flows over the whole muscle. So the way that information is transmitted in the presynaptic cell, it's electrical. Through the synapse, it's chemical. And then the postsynaptic cell, the information is converted back into an electrical signal. So it goes electrical, chemical, electrical for a chemical synapse. But for an electrical synapse, what is it? It's electrical, electrical, electrical. It never has to get converted into a chemical signal. So generally speaking, this signaling molecule is what we call a neurotransmitter because it's coming from this neuron right here. And do you have on the tip of your tongue any specific names of neurotransmitters? Acetylcholine. That would be the example, okay, at the neuromuscular junction. This is a neuromuscular, right, neuron and muscle, neuromuscular junction. This is a chemical synapse. And the neurotransmitter at all neuromuscular junctions is acetylcholine. Do you know how to abbreviate that? That is what? A, C, and then little H, acetylcholine. Other kinds of neurotransmitters would be like serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine, various kinds of neurotransmitters that we'll look at later on in the class. Okay? Okay. Other ways that cells can signal each other, and we call this endocrine signaling, where cells secrete a chemical, some kind of signaling molecule or a regulator. And if it's an endocrine gland, what can you tell me about an endocrine gland, the structure of an endocrine gland? What's the best way to think of endocrine gland? Has no ducts. That's right. An exocrine gland has a duct, like a salivary gland is an exocrine gland. It doesn't secrete saliva into the blood to take it to where it wants to go. It secretes it into a duct, and that duct takes saliva to where it should go. Where should it go? In your mouth, right? Yeah, it's not like your ear or someplace. It's your mouth, right? Okay, an endocrine gland, on the other hand, secretes its product out of the cell, not into a duct, into the interstitial fluid. And it moves by diffusion to a capillary someplace, and that chemical is absorbed by the capillary into the blood. And once it's in the blood, where does that signaling molecule go? Everywhere in the body, right? Because the blood goes everywhere in the body. Okay, so that particular signaling molecule, since it goes from a ductless gland directly into the blood, we call that a hormone. That's an endocrine signal. And the gland that secretes that is an endocrine gland. And the blood is going to take it everywhere. It will diffuse out of another capillary where there's a low concentration in the interstitial fluid. And then it's going to bind to a target organ. So what does this target organ have to have in order to bind a hormone? It's got to have a receptor protein, right? So we're going to see where these receptor proteins are. And once it binds, it's going to change the physiology of this particular cell. So therefore, this hormone is carrying information or a signal. It's going to change something inside this cell. And we have two different kinds of hormones, generally speaking. And generally speaking, we have two different kinds of compounds everywhere on the planet. There are ones that are polar and ones that are nonpolar. What does that mean? Let's talk about the nonpolar ones. What does nonpolar mean?
Hydrophobic.
That they're hydrophobic, don't necessarily like to be in water, and that means that they can diffuse through the plasma membrane because the plasma membrane, the inside is lipid. So these are lipid-type molecules that pass through the plasma membrane. So there are no receptors on the outside of the cell. There are receptors inside the cell. and maybe there's some in the nucleus, right? And that's no big problem because these are nonpolar. They can enter the cell because they're not affected by the membrane. They bind to a receptor, especially in the nucleus, and they can act as a transcription factor. Can you remember what a transcription factor does? It starts transcription. It allows the initiation of transcription, and transcription is the first step of what? It's the first step of? The first step of, you guys are like right on, but not exactly what I'm thinking. They're the first step in protein synthesis, right? So yeah, they're making RNA. Transcription is the production of RNA. That's the first step in protein synthesis. And then the second step happens automatically. We call that translation. So when a nonpolar regulatory molecule binds to a receptor in the nucleus, that affects protein synthesis that could produce enzymes, for instance, which is going to change metabolism inside that cell. All right, some examples would be steroid hormones, right? Because you know what the formula kind of looks like, or the structure of cholesterol looks like. That's a lipid molecule that can go right through the plasma membrane and affect protein synthesis inside the nucleus, which is going to change the function of that cell. And then there are also thyroid hormones. Thyroid hormone can go across the plasma membrane and change metabolism of cells that way. Polar regulatory molecules, on the other hand, can they get through the plasma membrane? Can a polar molecule get through the plasma membrane?
No.
Nope, because a polar molecule is hydrophilic. The membrane is hydrophobic. A polar molecule cannot get through. So if it's going to signal anything inside that cell, then it has to bind to a receptor that's on the outside of the cell. So it's going to be inside the membrane, but part of that receptor is going to be poking out into the interstitial fluid or extracellular fluid. And when it binds, then it has to somehow control metabolism inside the cell. And we're going to see how something on the outside of the cell can change something on the inside. And we call that signal transduction. So if we have a cell membrane right here, all right, and if we have a signaling molecule that binds to a receptor right here, so this molecule cannot get inside the cell, right? It's going to get bounced out. But because it binds to this receptor is going to change the physiology somehow inside the cell. And this process is what we call signal transduction, because this messenger right here doesn't get inside the cell. It has to be somehow transduced across the membrane. So this is what we call signal transduction. That's a pretty important part of this class, is to understand how signal transduction takes place. So we need to know something about receptors, different receptor types, and how it can change physiology inside the cell. And one way that we can do that is that it activates second messengers inside the cell. So the hormone on the outside is the first messenger, and whatever gets changed on the inside, we call that the second messenger. So second messenger is inside the cell, the first messenger is outside. But for a nonpolar molecule that can just enter the cell, we don't need second messengers because that steroid hormone is the first messenger. What can it do? It can get right inside the cell. It doesn't need a second messenger. It can just enter the cell all by itself. All right, some second messengers that are allowed to enter the cell might be, for instance, a really good one would be a calcium ion. Can you remember where is calcium high in concentration? Is it outside or inside, or is it the same on the outside and inside? It's high on the outside. It's almost zero on the inside. So that's a really good signaling molecule because it's almost zero on the inside until something tells it its concentration to increase. And there are two places where your body can get calcium. First, you told me it is high on the outside, right? So calcium can actually enter the cell from the outside. But there's another place, and I maybe forgot to mention this when we were talking about organelles. There's an organelle inside the cell which is a reservoir or storage area for calcium. And I don't think I mentioned it in this class. This organelle is also responsible, some of you might know from some other classes, or maybe I did mention it, there's an organelle that's responsible for lipid synthesis. What organelle is that? Smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Another function of smooth ER in some tissues, in some cells, is a storage form of calcium. So it takes calcium out of the cytosol, puts it inside the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, and then it's out of the cytosol. And with the proper signal, the smooth ER releases that calcium inside the cell, which changes the physiology of the cell. Okay, cyclic AMP is a good second messenger as well, and G proteins. We're going to look at G proteins. G proteins are part of a second messenger pathway in many cells. This kind of receptor molecule. All right, so what kind of molecule is this G protein that's in the membrane going to be listening for? A polar molecule or a nonpolar? The G protein is on the outside of the cell, so it's going to be a polar molecule because the polar can't get inside. It's got to bind to something on the outside of the cell. G proteins are good for doing that. And G proteins are the oldest kind of receptors in living systems. So even in an evolutionary sense, even very, very old cells have G proteins for communication. Like, I don't know, what kind of cell is a really old cell? Like slugs and turtles and even simpler forms of life, sharks and things like that, okay? And the shape, the general nature of these kinds of receptors hasn't changed very much over millions and millions of years of evolution. So we say it's highly conserved because it works so well, nothing really could replace its function. It's very good. So a G protein coupled receptor contains three subunits, and these subunits can dissociate when the surface receptor is activated, and these three subunits can move around on the top surface of the membrane, and they can bump into other things that are in the membrane, like maybe a channel or an enzyme. And when one of these subunits bumps into a channel, it can open it up under some circumstances or maybe close a channel down, or it can activate an enzyme or maybe stop the activity of an enzyme. All right, and then after it has an effect on these membrane proteins, it will go back and reform into three subunits and attach to the receptor protein. So I'm sure this is an exam figure right here. This is a nice graphic that shows what a G protein looks like. So what can you tell me about this structure right here? What does that look like? Phospholipid bilayer, which is what? Typical kind of membrane, right? But you should be a little bit more sophisticated and know that the phospholipid bilayer is what? Just a very bare bones way to describe the plasma membrane. What's even a better way to describe plasma membrane? Fluid mosaic model. So we can dissolve other kinds of things in the membrane, like proteins, for instance. And here's an example of a receptor protein right here. And this is a G protein because I see three other subunits that are in the cellular side that have bound to the receptor. Okay, so this receptor goes across the membrane. And here is a binding site on the receptor protein, and it has already bound some kind of regulatory molecule right here. This could be a neurotransmitter, for instance, or maybe a hormone. And how would you describe the association or the relationship between this binding site and the signaling molecule? Could you describe that relationship at all? I think we talked about it a little bit in terms of transporters. So receptors and transporters share the same characteristics. So for transporters, we said it was what? Specificity. There was saturation and what? Competition. So the best way to describe the association of this regulatory molecule with this receptor site right here is that the shape of these molecules have to be complementary. So if the signaling molecule is spherical or round, what's the shape of the receptor protein right here? Could it be triangular or columnar or square? No, it's got to be what? Spherical, to match up with the shape of the regulatory molecule. And then it can bind. Okay. So it responds to, well, you have to consider all those things that we consider for membrane transporters. Specificity, if the shape is different, it won't bind. Competition, that means other things that have the same shape can bind to the receptor. And saturation, that means that as this concentration of the regulatory molecule increases, after all of the receptors are bound that we have in this plasma membrane right here, there could be no further increase of response inside the cell because all the receptors are now taken up with the regulatory molecule. All right, so once the regulatory molecule binds, then this complex, right, so this is the G protein down over here. It has three chains, right? It's got an alpha, beta, and a gamma. And the alpha subunit has a binding site for guanosine triphosphate. And guanosine triphosphate is similar to another molecule that you have in your body. Could you guess what other molecule is similar to it in terms of the energy it has? It has ATP. Yeah, it's similar to ATP. So GTP is a high-energy molecule, just like ATP. And GTP will bind to this alpha subunit right here. And when, okay, the regulatory molecule binds to it, then the beta and gamma subunit will disassociate from the alpha. And all three of these, right, the beta, the gamma, and the alpha, will dissociate from the receptor molecule. And they will diffuse around right on the inside surface of the plasma membrane. They can wander around wherever that plasma membrane goes. They're not going to float around inside the cell. They're always going to be attached to the membrane. So again, remember the membrane is what? Fluid. And these parts can float around on the surface, on the inside right here. But we can have other things in this membrane besides a receptor protein. We can have, for instance, what? A channel, for instance. So that could be effector number one over here. Or effector number two, this could be an enzyme. And maybe this channel is closed under normal circumstances, but when the beta and gamma subunit bump into it, that might open up a channel. And for instance, maybe that's a sodium channel. And what does sodium like to do when a channel all of a sudden opens up? It likes to go in. Why does it like to go in? Because the concentration gradient is favorable to that and the electrical gradient favors that, so sodium will want to rush in the cell. That's going to change the electrical property of the cell. Or maybe when the alpha subunit bumps into another effector, maybe that's an enzyme. And that's going to catalyze a reaction inside the cell, a reaction that the cell couldn't perform before. Right, so that both of these circumstances changes the physiology inside the cell. And after a while, the beta and gamma and alpha subunits recombine. And when they recombine, okay, it's going to release this inorganic phosphate and produce this GDP right here. And the signaling molecule is going to be released. And so now the receptor is reset back to its original state, and it's ready to listen for another receptor signal. I mean, another maybe a hormone signal. Signaling molecule can bind to this receptor site and can start this process all over again. So alpha, beta, and gamma are what we call the G protein. This is the receptor protein in the membrane. And when it binds the regulatory molecule, then it can change the physiology inside the cell by either changing the electrical properties of the cell or the metabolism of the cell by affecting enzymes inside the cell. And the reason why this works is because it uses some energy inside the cell, namely, what's the energy source for this G protein? It's GTP. Okay? All right, so we're going to employ this G protein a number of different times in the class. It'll probably make more sense when we actually give it an actual application and not just a general application that you see right here. But if I start talking about a specific application without learning some of these general ways that a G protein works, it won't make any sense whatsoever. So this is just the first step. Okay, so I think this is the last slide. All right, so this is a G protein coupled receptor complex that can listen to this regulatory protein right here, regulatory molecule. All right. Okay, so next we've got to cover chapter 4 and 5. So 4 I can cover in one day and in 2 days. So you know what? Our test might be next Thursday, not this Thursday coming up, but next week Thursday, or actually the material in 5 is a little bit difficult. The material in 4 is not very difficult at all, but the material in 5 you have to think about a little bit, so I might actually put it off until the weekend after next week even. So it might be Tuesday, not of next week, but the week after. So you got to come to class Thursday to find out how we're doing with that.
So when are we
having
our
class? So when are we? Okay. I don't know. I have to get a calendar out to see what date. So not next week, and maybe not even Thursday of the week after that. Okay. And it will be the Tuesday of the following week. Yeah. That might be right. Yeah, the 9th or the...
Tuesday would be the 14th, yeah.
So it all depends on how far we get with stuff. Okay, so this is an easy chapter, so I expect you guys to kind of breeze through this one already. You've had some labs, so probably this weekend, you got to make sure you're familiar with this material and actually start on chapter 6, which is metabolism.
That's chapter 5.
Yeah, we're done with 6. Chapter 5, right, chapter 5, which is metabolism. Okay, so you got to spend some time before lecture with that one. Okay, so we're going to look at some enzymes. What a definition of a metabolic pathway is, and we'll talk just a little bit about bioenergetics, but that's a topic you've covered already in lab, but we'll review that. Okay, so an enzyme. Let's talk about an enzyme. What the heck is an enzyme? Maybe you even had a lab on this already. Okay. An enzyme is a biological catalyst. So what does a catalyst do? It speeds up the rate of a reaction. That's excellent that you should have. That's an excellent explanation of what a catalyst does. It cannot make a reaction happen that thermodynamically is unfavorable. It can't make a reaction happen that does not want to happen. Like, for instance, make things go from low concentration to high all by itself. It can only make reactions go, for instance, that move things from high concentration to low, things that will automatically happen. So, for instance, let's consider this particular reaction right here. Hydrogen, what's this? I think I wrote this on the board at one time. Hydrogen peroxide. For every hydrogen atom, there's an oxygen, so we call that hydrogen peroxide. Who's got hydrogen peroxide at home? Probably everybody does, because it's nice for when you cut yourself, because you can clean a wound out, like a laceration or something, or an abrasion. But what does hydrogen peroxide turn into? It turns into water plus oxygen, and that's handy because pure oxygen is kind of toxic to bacteria, so it's a bacteriostatic agent. The water that's produced irrigates the wound, it flushes it out. You know, if there's debris in there, that helps prevent infection. All right, now what kind of color bottle is that hydrogen peroxide in? Clear bottle? Clear glass bottle? No. It's usually a dark plastic bottle because you're trying to keep light out of it. That's why. Because if you have hydrogen peroxide in a bottle and you've had that hydrogen peroxide for 10 years in your medicine cabinet, you know what? There's probably no hydrogen peroxide left in there. Hydrogen peroxide all by itself likes to turn into water and oxygen. So that's the favorable reaction. Okay. All right, but it takes a long time for that to happen. Like I said, what, 10 years? For sure in 20 years all of that hydrogen peroxide is gone. But now if you take some brand new hydrogen peroxide that you bought and pour it on a cut, what happens to it? It's like a volcano, right? Because that reaction happens really fast. What allows that reaction to happen really fast when you pour it on a cut? There is something here that speeds up the rate of that chemical reaction. What do we call that thing that speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction? Okay, a catalyst. And in particular, a biological catalyst, because you're biology, which is an enzyme. So there is an enzyme that your body makes that speeds up this reaction. And the name of that enzyme, there's a number of different kinds of enzymes that do that, but for instance, catalase is one example, and peroxidase is another specific, ASE peroxidase. And as a matter of fact, you learned of a vesicle that's loaded with peroxidase. That's a peroxisome. And what's the job of that peroxisome? To take hydrogen peroxide that your body produces in some quantities, which is pretty toxic, right, to cellular processes in it, what's the job of peroxisome is to detoxify. It detoxifies hydrogen peroxide that your body normally produces. Okay. So that enzyme speeds up the rate of that chemical reaction. It will happen automatically, but it will take a really long time. Like, for instance, this wood right here that makes up this desk. Is it completely stable? It kind of looks like it's not going anywhere. Okay, but if we give it a couple million years, guess what that wood is going to turn into all by itself? That is going to turn into carbon dioxide and water. All right, and we could speed that reaction up. How could we speed that reaction up? By putting some energy into it, like what? Like a match or something. Okay, increase the energy of that wood, and it's going to turn real fast into carbon dioxide and water. Okay, there's no enzyme involved right here, but there's a catalyst that we could come up with. Some people maybe are familiar with this, but if we have zinc, it's a little metal. If we put zinc on wood, it will burn it even at low temperature. I should actually do that in lab. Okay, without bursting it into flame, it will just burn a hole right through the wood. It will be a catalyst, right, speed up that reaction. But, so wood naturally wants to turn into carbon dioxide and water. So there is some barrier that's preventing that from happening under most circumstances. All right, so what about an enzyme? Most are proteins, a couple aren't. There might be more that we don't know about. And enzymes then act by lowering the activation energy required for a reaction to proceed. So again, let's look at my automobile. Here's my car. And where did I have to park my car? On top of the hill, right? So here's my car on top of the hill. And what does my car want to do all by itself? It will want to roll down the hill. All right, but let's just say I don't want my car to roll down the hill. What can I do? And there were probably some times where I thought, well, gee whiz, you know, if the starter motor wasn't working or if the battery wasn't dead or blah, 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 maybe the parking brake isn't going to work one of these days, so I better put what? How do I prevent my car from rolling down the hill? I don't know if I could trust my emergency brake. I know something that would always work. I could put a rock right here. So I could put a big rock right there, right? And now the car won't roll down the hill. Will it want to roll down the hill? It wants to roll down the hill, but it can't because that block is there, right? So how could we get the car to roll down the hill with the block there? We could come along with a big bus or truck or something, right, and then bonk my car, hit it really hard, and what would happen? Because my big toe on my left foot wouldn't be strong enough to lift it up over the block like I used to do right before. So if I have this big bus hitting the bus could push the car up over the block, right, and then it would roll down the hill. So this block right here acts like an activation energy barrier. This is a barrier that is preventing the reaction from taking place. But if we put in enough energy ahead of time to get it up over the block, what's going to happen to the car? It's going to roll down the hill. So the same thing, for instance, like burning wood. We could get it to turn into carbon dioxide and water, but what do we have to do first? Give it more energy to get over this activation energy so that the wood would burn. Okay, but this is true of what? All these, most chemical reactions, like even hydrogen peroxide going into water, right? What this enzyme does, it speeds up the rate of this reaction by reducing the activation energy. In my car example, how could we reduce the activation energy of this reaction? If we hit it with a bus, okay, we can overcome that activation energy by brute force, by adding enough energy to get it over the block. But what's a more elegant solution? So I wouldn't have to call my friend with the bus. I could just, move the block out of the way. All right, that's reducing the activation energy, and that reaction now will happen a whole lot faster. All right, so that's activation energy. Okay, so what do enzymes do? Speed up the rate of a reaction. And how do they do that? By decreasing the activation energy for a particular reaction. All right, so here we have a couple graphs. And the top graphs we see number of reactant molecules. I'm going to have to get a different mouse maybe. Or come right here. All right, so here we have number of reactant molecules. Okay. Plotted versus the energy. So the energy of these reactant molecules, there's not just one single energy level. And this, the energy levels of these reactant molecules can be described with this bell-shaped curve. So some have very low energy, some have very high energy, but most have what? Like an average energy right here. And for a chemical reaction to take place, when there is an activation energy, only a very few number of molecules signified by this area that's colored, what is that, like gold or something? Green? That's similar. Okay, this green color right here, I guess I didn't do this again. Okay, the green color, these are the number of molecules that can overcome this energy barrier, which is what? Just a small number. But if somehow we can reduce this energy barrier, what's going to happen to the number of molecules that have sufficient energy to jump over that energy barrier? So if we reduce it, right, we can increase the number of molecules that have the sufficient energy to get over this energy barrier to form products right here. So this is another pretty handy graph to look at that shows energy barrier and the number of molecules. So in this particular condition, condition 2 over here, all right, the reaction will proceed faster because more molecules have sufficient energy to overcome that activation energy barrier. Okay, so how does that happen? Let's define what a typical chemical reaction again is with our hydrogen peroxide equation over here. All right, so on the left-hand side of the equation, what do we call all these molecules over here on the left-hand side? These are reactants. And on the right-hand side, we have products. All right, so let's think of a chemical reaction. Let's use these two markers right here. And let's just say that we start with two reactants and we want to end up with one, what is that? That's a product. Right, so we go from two molecules to one. What do we call that? That is, that's like a dehydration synthesis, for instance, or what? Anabolism. That's just a review from the first test, right? That's anabolism. All right, well, how do we have to put these two reactant molecules together to form a product? Or how many different ways can these molecules bump into each other? Can they bump into each other like this? Okay, or like that? Yeah, or like that? Like that? Okay, like that? Will a product form? No. How do these molecules have to bump into each other to form a product? Only one way, like that. So there are millions of possibilities of how molecules can bump into each other, but there's only one way that they bump into each other to form a product. All right, so that actually describes activation energy. When you can figure out a way to put two molecules together so that they have to form a product, that decreases the activation energy of that reaction. And that's how an enzyme works, by decreasing the activation energy. All right, so the ability of enzymes to lower energy requirements is due to the structure of the enzyme. Right? Enzymes have a highly ordered three-dimensional shape because why? Enzymes are what kind of biological molecule? They're a protein. So protein has a primary structure, right, a secondary structure, tertiary structure, which has a particular shape. That shape is what we call a conformation. So when your body builds a protein, it has its normal configuration. We call that native configuration or native conformation. That's how the protein should be made. And on the surface of that protein, it contains pockets or dimples or little depressions. And some of those depressions are an active site into which a substrate reactant can fit into. So in an enzyme-catalyzed reaction, in this particular case, we don't really call these reactants over here. We call these substrates. So substrates are converted into products for an enzyme-catalyzed reaction. So enzymes act by bringing the substrates close together so that they react. But how do they react? Just in that one proper way to have them form products, right? That one proper way. That's what an enzyme does. All right, so next slide. Okay, so here we see two substrates, substrate A and B. We see an enzyme molecule which looks, blue, purple, blue, right up over here. Okay, so here we see an active site for substrate A. Here's an active site for substrate B. And notice that these are complementary in shape to the substrates. So if this is a big square hole, for instance, and the substrate wouldn't bind to it, the reaction won't take place. So the shape of the active site has to be complementary to the shape of the substrate molecule. The same thing for substrate B. It has to have the right shape to fit into the active site. And here we have the enzyme. All right. So what happens first is the substrates bind, and it forms a new kind of molecule. So here's a molecule that's part enzyme and part substrates. So we call this the enzyme-substrate complex. And this complex has to form before the products are formed. So here you can see the two products, C and D, right over here. So what did the arrangement of these active sites do? It allowed these two substrates to come together and touch each other in just the right way for what to happen? For these products to form. And once the products are formed, they're released from the active sites and you're given the enzyme again. All right, so this probably is an exam figure. And what teachers always ask is, what has to form before the products are formed in an enzyme-catalyzed reaction? There's a new molecule that has to form. And so what would you like to say? What would you like to say? What molecule has to form before the products are formed? The enzyme-substrate complex. So if this enzyme-substrate complex can't form for whatever reason, then the products can't form either, right? Okay. So here we have an enzyme before the reaction, and here is the enzyme after the reaction right here. What's the difference between the enzyme before and the enzyme afterwards? Okay, I heard it. That was the correct answer. There is no difference. All right, so during this particular reaction, an enzyme-catalyzed reaction, substrates get converted into products. That changes. The concentration of substrate decreases. The concentration of product increases. But the enzyme concentration stays the same. It does not degrade. So that's just true of any kind of catalyst, whether it's a biological catalyst or even an inorganic catalyst. The catalyst never goes away during the reaction. So it can catalyze this reaction, what? Over and over and over and over and over again. Okay? That's not to say that a protein doesn't have a lifespan. It has a lifespan in your body. Okay? But in terms of catalyzing this reaction, it can catalyze it, you know, thousands, millions of times over and over and over again without becoming degraded. Okay, so don't forget, the enzyme is unaltered. And here is just a nice equation. But for reactants right here, what should you really say? You should really say substrates, right, for an enzyme-catalyzed reaction. All right, so most enzymes end in the name ASE. Like, for instance, what do we have on the board for hydrogen peroxide? You have catalase. You have peroxidase. These just tell you that it's an enzyme. Okay? And a lot of times, enzymes are named according to their activity. For instance, like a phosphatase. Phosphatase has something to do with phosphate, right? And it's going to remove a phosphate from a large molecule. And a kinase, it's not in the name right here, you know it's an ace, it's a protein, but a kinase will add a phosphate to some kind of big molecule, right? And that's going to change the activity of that molecule. Maybe it's an enzyme that is catalyzing a reaction. So let me just draw that on the board real quick. So here we have some kind of protein molecule like this. And maybe let's just say it's an inactive enzyme. And we're going to take ATP, and it's going to come up over here, and it's going to bind this phosphate. And what's it going to release? It's going to release ADP, okay, plus energy. But the energy is going to be used to change this thing into something that has a nice active site, something that looks like this. Okay, and there's that phosphate. And so the enzyme that phosphorylates this protein right here is what we call a kinase. And the kinase has done what? It has activated, it has turned on this enzyme. It has given it some physiologic role inside the cell. All right, now how can that happen? Well, phosphate, remember, is a pretty big molecule, right? It's got a bunch of oxygens on it. It's charged, right? So it has a lot of ionic characteristic to it. It's a big molecule. So it can change the shape because it's using the energy in ATP to change the shape as well. So there's energy in ATP that can change the shape. Think of if I take my little finger, right, and you are this inactive enzyme, and I take my little finger and I poke you in the side, what's going to happen? You're gonna move, right? You're going to change your conformation. Just like this enzyme is going to change conformation when we jab this big phosphate molecule onto it. And you change the shape of that enzyme, you change the shape of the enzyme, you're going to change the activity of the enzyme because maybe you're constructing this active site right here. Okay, so sometimes, so that's a kinase, all right, but how can we turn this enzyme off? So let's take this enzyme and make it go back the other way, this way. All right, so this kinase makes it go over here. What's it makes it, so this would be a phosphatase, right? And so then that's going to release inorganic phosphate, and it's going to go back to this configuration that does not have any activity. So this is like the kinase and the phosphatase is acting like a switch to turn on and turn off this enzymatic activity. All right, so phosphatase and kinase, we're going to talk almost throughout the whole rest of the class. So automatically you should say kinase does what? It phosphorylates something, and a phosphatase is dephosphorylate something. Okay, so a kinase phosphorylates, a phosphatase dephosphorylates something. All right, many are named by the substrate of the enzyme. So what's a substrate again? That's just a reactant. So for instance, lactose is a sugar. It's broken down by an enzyme. Can anybody tell me the name of the enzyme that breaks down lactose? Lactose is the sugar. It is lactase. Okay? Like a protein. What is a general name of a molecule that can break down a protein? It's a protease. Protease. And an enzyme that breaks down lipid would be a lipase. All right, so that nomenclature is pretty easy to see. Here's a table with some important kinds of enzymes in it. Catalase, we talked about. Carbonic anhydrase, we're going to talk about a lot. All right, carbonic anhydrase can take CO2. Do you have any CO2 in your body? You make CO2 all the time. And that's the topic of the next chapter, actually. And carbon dioxide can be converted very easily into carbonic acid in our body, and it's transported very nicely. And what catalyzes this reaction right here is carbonic anhydrase. There is an enzyme that breaks down starch. What's the building block of starch? Glucose, right? Starch is just pure glucose. Amylase will chop off two glucoses via a hydrolysis reaction. and two glucoses put together. Glucose. I think I showed you a slide already. What do we call that? That's a disaccharide, but in particular it's got a name. That's called? That is maltose. All right, so amylase. Your salivary glands secrete amylase to do some digestion of starch, and your pancreas secretes amylase. And these other two we'll talk about later in the class. All right, so enzyme activity. Enzyme activity is the rate at which substrates are converted into products. Okay, what can you tell me about an enzyme when substrates are converted into products? Nothing happens to it, right? It just stays that enzyme. It just stays the same. Okay. And the rate at which an enzyme can change substrate into product is dependent on a number of different things. First is temperature. So here we have a plot of enzyme activity. This is what? The rate that products are being formed, or the consumption of reactants or substrates, versus temperature. So as the temperature increases, what happens to the rate of that enzyme-catalyzed reaction? Can you see that it increases? As temperature increases, the rate of enzymatic activity increases. It looks pretty linear. And why the heck is that happening? What is temperature really a measure of? What is temperature a measure of? Movement. Remember, I think I put on the board this kind of protein at one time, and I said that's just a still photograph of a protein. That's not a very good representation, because if we want to take a nice graphical representation of that molecule, what should we really do? Not just take a picture of it, but a video, because it's doing what? It's twisting, it's bending, it's vibrating all the time. And as we increase the temperature, what happens to all that motion? That increases too, right? So that means that molecules are bumping into each other more frequently as the temperature increases. That just means that over a period of time, you'll have more molecules bumping into each other just the right way to form products, because they're bumping into each other faster. Okay? The same thing for an enzyme-catalyzed reaction. The substrates will bind to the active site more frequently as the temperature increases. But what happens when we get to about 40 degrees or 37 degrees, actually 40 degrees? What happens to enzymatic activity? You see, it starts to decrease. And this is a special part in this curve right here. We give it a special term, and we call this denaturation. All right, so enzymatic activity is stopping, and we get to a certain point, it actually goes to zero. If we were to actually finish drawing this line, we would see that it goes to zero right over here. Now, what is happening here? When we reach that certain temperature, this molecule is bending and twisting so fast, you could think of this molecule as being a spring, right? If you hit a spring just right, it will sit there and vibrate. But have you ever had a spring and you pulled it so far, or you twisted it so far, it got sprung? I don't know how else to describe it. You just change the shape of that spring, and no matter what you do, you can never get it to go back to look like a spring again. Right? So the same thing with this protein. Maybe it's going to look like this now. Right, and it used to look like that. All right, so what do we call this process? Going from its native configuration or conformation to this denatured form. Yeah, so this is denaturation. That's denaturation. And if this enzyme had a nice active site right here to bind substrates, do you see an active site here? It's gone. So if there's no active site, then something can't form. What can't form? What's the middle step of that enzyme-catalyzed reaction? The enzyme-substrate complex. So once an enzyme is denatured, the active site is gone, the enzyme-substrate complex can't form, and if the enzyme-substrate complex can't form, neither can the products, right? So the activity of this enzyme has been killed. And another way of thinking about this is that we could say this is what? Cooking. We've cooked that protein. And you do that all the time. With what? Yeah, those would be good substrates. But what kind of energy do you use to cook most of the time? Yeah, it's heat. It's with temperature, right? So it's this first graph over here. But how else can you cook food? You don't have to cook food with temperature. You can cook food with what else? with acid with by changing the pH or even the salt concentration, because that can change the shape of this molecule by disrupting ionic bonds and hydrogen bonds, right? That can denature. What's a good food that you can cook with acid? Like ceviche, right? Like sauerbraten, lots of different kinds of foods. Okay. Now, when we're operating in this part of the curve right here, up to the plateau from cold, where there's zero activity, up to the maximum right here, if we change the temperature back and forth, what's going to happen to the activity of this enzyme? If we increase the temperature, it's going to increase, and if we decrease the temperature, it's going to decrease. And then if we increase the temperature again, what's going to happen? It's going to increase again, right? It can go back and forth, right? But once we're on this end of the curve, and we denature this protein, right, and we cool it down in temperature, so we take this protein and we increase the activity and then we denature it so its activity goes to zero and then cool it down, what's its activity always going to be? It's always going to be zero, because even though we change the temperature back down, it's not ever going to go back to its native configuration. And you have a good sense of that. For instance, when you go home tonight and you cook a hamburger on the grill, oh, you can't go home tonight and cook a hamburger on the grill, can you? I shouldn't have, that's a lousy example. But anyway, maybe you'll do that in lab, okay? So you cook a hamburger in lab, and can you tell there's a difference in the raw hamburger compared to the cooked hamburger? Certainly, because you've denatured all of those proteins there. And then you're ready to sit down and eat that hamburger, right? It's cooked, ready to go, nice and warm. And you get a call on your cell phone, and it's your friend that says, hopefully I didn't give you this example already. Did I give you this example already? Okay. Did I already? I think maybe I did, right? You get a call on your cell phone, and it's your friend saying, come shoot some pool with us because the table just opened up. So can you take that cold hamburger and put it in the refrigerator? You sure can. But does it ever go back to looking like raw hamburger again?
No.
Because when you denature something, it's what? It's an irreversible change. Right, you can get it cold, but it can never go back to a raw hamburger again. All right. Okay, so temperature changes the vibration modes of a protein. It can change the shape of a protein, but so can pH. All right, so here we have a plot of enzyme activity versus pH. Here is an enzyme called pepsin. It's important for the digestion of proteins, and it has an optimal pH of 2. So, and we see that at pH 1, it's almost zero activity. At pH 0, it is zero activity. But by the time we get to pH 6, it's almost at zero activity again. So we see that it has an optimal pH for activity, and then the activity decreases when we move away from that optimum. How would you explain this decrease in activity with pH? When you change the pH, what is happening to the enzyme? What's happening to the enzyme? Yeah, as you change the pH, you're subtly changing the shape of the molecule by changing the hydrogen bonding between the different strands of this protein right here, the different filaments of it, maybe changing the ionic bonds, right? The van der Waals forces get stressed, and the protein changes shape. And if the protein changes shape, what happens to the active site? Then it changes, and it's no longer appropriate to bind a substrate because the substrate doesn't change shape in the same way that the enzyme changes shape. So if the active site changes shape, then the enzyme substrate complex can't form and products can't form as a result of that. So here you see a couple enzymes, pepsin, that operates in your stomach at a low pH, salivary amylase from your salivary glands in your mouth, that's more of a neutral pH. And then to complete digestion of proteins in the small intestine, your small intestine is not acidic, it's very basic, and intestinal enzymes have an optimal pH right around 8 or 9 or so to finish the digestion of protein. So it's very radical changes in pH to digest a protein. All right, so if an enzyme, what does an enzyme have to have in order for it to have the proper function? In order for the enzyme to have the proper physiology, what does it have to have? Yeah, what's that active site? Would you call that physiology, or what would you call that? It's the shape. What's the study of shape?
Shape.
What's the study of function? Physiology. What's the study of shape? Structure. What's the study of structure? Anatomy. Right? Okay, you guys knew that years ago. All right, certainly at the beginning of the semester. So in order for an enzyme to have the proper physiology, it has to have the proper what? Anatomy, right? In order for the enzyme to have the proper function, it's got to have the proper shape because of that active site right there. So that's what? A nice structural functional relationship, even at the molecular level, for controlling metabolism, right? Controlling the rate of chemical reactions in your body, because that's what an enzyme does. It speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction in your body. So always relate structure to function, even with enzymes. Here are some more enzymes and what kind of pHs that they operate at. I don't think I'm going to go over that. But this is a pretty important slide. Let's see, we started at 4, 5. Okay, we got a couple minutes left. Okay. Cofactors and coenzymes. Here are a couple important terms. These are things that can promote or inhibit a enzyme-catalyzed reaction. And a cofactor is a small metal ion, such as calcium. Calcium is a metal. Magnesium is a metal. What's Mn? Manganese, that's from the first test. Cu is copper, and Zn is zinc. Our bodies need, and also selenium, okay? Our body needs small quantities of these metal ions because they're necessary for enzymatic activity because they are cofactors. And I'll show you why a cofactor works in just a little bit. The second kind of molecule is called a coenzyme. And a coenzyme are derived from vitamins. These are large organic molecules. And maybe I'll show you at the end of the very last PowerPoint is a couple examples of an organic molecule. What's an organic molecule again? What does it have to have? At least what? Carbon and hydrogen, but it could have what? 10, scores, 20, 30, 40 carbon atoms and nitrogen and, you know, the same for hydrogen. So it's a big molecule. These ions right here are what? Little teeny tiny molecules, right? They're small metal ions. So cofactor is inorganic. A coenzyme is organic, and the cofactor is small, coenzyme is big. A cofactor will bind to an enzyme. A coenzyme won't necessarily bind to an enzyme, but it's a transporter molecule. It will transport intermediates of a metabolic pathway from one enzymatic reaction to another. So let's look and see how a cofactor might work. Here we have an enzyme, and you can see a couple active sites right here and right here. And these active sites are supposed to bind, what, substrates. And in this particular case, we don't have the cofactor bound to the enzyme, and so the active sites are not proper for the substrates to fit into it. But once the cofactor binds to the enzyme, that's going to change the shape of the enzyme a little bit, enough to make the active sites proper so that the substrates can bind to it. And this is what, the enzyme substrate complex? What can form after the enzyme substrate complex? Products can form. Okay, and that might be what, the combination of these two molecules right here. So a cofactor is something that changes the shape of the, can you see the change in shape of the enzyme? Right, it changes the conformation of the enzyme, even though it's a small molecule, and it makes the active site more appropriate so that it conforms with the shape of the substrate, and that increases the rate of the chemical reaction. So a cofactor can bind to a site other than the active site, or in this particular example, we see a cofactor actually binding to and helps form the active site. That's still a cofactor. And now we have the enzyme substrate complex, which can then form products. Wow, what did I do? Okay. So that's a cofactor. Okay, coenzymes just carry things around. I'll give you some examples of cofactors in a little bit. Okay, enzyme activation. There are some enzymes that are produced in an inactive form, like digestive enzymes made in the pancreas. If a pancreas were to make digestive enzymes in an active form, what would happen to the pancreas? all by itself. It would be digested all by itself. That happens under some circumstances, and guess what? That's really nasty. That's really bad, really hard to treat. Pancreatic cancer, pancreatitis, for instance. Okay. So pancreatic enzymes are produced in an inactive form. They're transported to the small intestine where they are activated. And that's where they're supposed to be activated, in the small intestine, because the small intestine can protect itself from self-digestion. And the way that we can activate these enzymes is by using a phosphatase or a kinase, by phosphorylating them, for instance. So that's going to convert them into an active form. All right, so we kind of talked about that mechanism already. All right, so enzymes show those same characteristics that we looked at for transporters, namely specificity and saturation and competition. All right, so for instance, here we have a plot of reaction rate versus substrate concentration. If we increase, and let's just keep the enzyme concentration constant. We're not changing the enzyme concentration. It's the same. If we increase the substrate concentration, what happens to the rate of the reaction? It's increasing because now more substrate is binding to more and more enzyme. Okay, but after a certain limit is reached, even if we add more substrate at this level right here, all the active sites on all the enzyme that you have is bound to the substrate. So if we increase the substrate, the reaction rate does what? It stays the same. So this level right here is just a maximum rate, and that is described by saturation. All the enzyme is bound to substrate, so there's nothing we can do. What can we do to increase the rate of this reaction without changing the substrate concentration or the enzyme concentration? We could increase the temperature, as long as we don't cook the enzyme, right? We could take it right up to where we cook it, and that would increase the rate. All right, but let's keep temperature the same. So this is saturation. Also, other molecules, let's put in, instead of one substrate, let's put in another molecule that looks similar to the substrate. What's going to happen to this rate of the reaction? It's going to increase, but then it's going to level off at some lower level because now the enzyme is binding some of the competitor. Right? So that would be an example of competition. So maybe you could go back and look at those other PowerPoints that show the effect of competition right here. So receptors and enzymes share a lot of activity. And you know what? We got to start here next time. This right here shows the law of mass action, and I'll mention it again next time. It can be described by another principle. And does anybody know what another principle of the law of mass action is? This is sometimes what we call Le Chatelier's principle. So these reactions can go back and forth, and we'll show you how it's determined, if it's going to be in the forward direction or reverse direction. Okay, it's by the concentration of these species right here. So if we pour a lot of CO2 onto this side, it's going to force the reaction to the right. If we get rid of a lot of CO2, it's going to force the reaction back to regenerate some of the CO2. So that's a law of mass action, or Le Chatelier's principle. So what's your lab quiz tonight?
Metabolism.
Metabolism. Oh, rat metabolism. Cool. What's the point of metabolism? What is the whole point of metabolism? Not to kill. The whole point is not to kill the animal, right? That's metabolism. That's metabolism, but specifically, this probably won't be on your metabolism. Yeah, respiration. The whole point of respiration is to make ATP. Right? Is to just make ATP. And we're going to learn a number of different ways your body can make ATP, different kinds of respiration, but the bottom line is that it's going to make ATP. What molecule is consumed when respiration makes ATP? Okay, you measured it in the lab. That is, oxygen is consumed. And you measured the rate of oxygen consumption, which is sort of like measuring the rate of ATP production or utilization even. Okay, You didn't have to worry about CO2. How come you didn't have to worry about CO2 in your mouse? Your mouse chamber. Yeah, because you put ascaride in there that absorbed it, took it out of the air that the mouse was breathing. Okay? And you didn't have to worry about the water vapor that the mouse was putting into the chamber either. Because why? You put dry rite in there. So you put ascaride and dry rite in there to get rid of these gases. Right? And you only looked at oxygen consumption as a result of that. Those are good kind of questions I would ask on the quiz for that lab. Because you guys did it. Okay. Well, you guys are luckier compared to my next class tonight. Why is that? Because I got a test. You're thankful.
Cool. That was his bachelor's, Terrence. He had a little